Episode 112, Brown Dwarfs, Dark Matter and Dark Energy. In this episode, I spoke with Professor Eduardo L. Martin, who is based at the Instituto de Astrofísica de Canarias in Tenerife. He's working on the European Space Agency mission Euclid. Professor Martin is not part of the Euclid Consortium, the around 2,500 scientists and engineers from more than a dozen countries who operate the Euclid mission. He is one of two Euclid mission's independent legacy scientists. He's supported by a postdoc, Marusa Sirgel, and a student, Diego Martin, funded by the European Research Council. Professor Martin is a specialist in substellar bodies, that is, celestial bodies with the size of about Jupiter, but with around 50 times its mass. When initially theorized in the 1960s, these were called black dwarfs, but renamed in the 1970s by Jill Tarter as brown dwarfs. Brown dwarfs generate energy only through gravitational compression, not nuclear fission. There is an overlap in surface temperature between young brown dwarfs and the old, very low-mass stars. Professor Martin and his collaborators have developed spectroscopic methods to distinguish brown dwarfs from other stars, in particular the lithium test. More about this interesting role of lithium in cosmology in Professor Martin's book, published in 2023 by the Institute of Physics, entitled Lithium Cross the Universe, a link where you can download several free-to-read chapters is on the webpage for this episode. Brown dwarfs emit mostly in the infrared, not optical light, as our sun. One of the two instruments on Euclid operates in the infrared and can detect these dark, ultra-cold objects of substellar mass. In time, Euclid will shed light on both dark matter and dark energy. It was launched in July 2023 and arrived in its L2 orbit a month later. It has just two instruments, which will produce a high-resolution 3D map of a third of the sky stretching back 10 billion years during its initial 6 years operational lifetime. Perhaps the most pressing question for astrophysicists is, what is the cosmos made of? They have known for a long time that visible matter accounts only for 5%, dark matter 27%, and dark energy 68%. Currently, most of the attributes of dark matter and dark energy remain a mystery. Helping to shed some answers to these questions is Euclid's primary goal. Visible matter is something that we are surrounded by. It responds to all four known forces: electromagnetic, gravitational, the strong and weak nuclear force. Dark matter is not dark. It's invisible and is only detected through its gravitational influence on the matter we can see. Gravitational lensing, for example, is one manifestation. Whereas gravity is a force of attraction, dark energy is repulsive, powering the expansion of the universe. Its effects are observed by monitoring Type 1a supernovae in distant galaxies. Some scientists consider dark energy as the cosmological constant that Einstein initially added and then removed from his general theory of relativity. The cosmological constant is now considered by some as the fifth fundamental force after gravity, electromagnetism, strong and weak nuclear forces. More about the Euclid mission, images released so far, and a summary of the attributes of normal matter, and dark energy are available on the webpage for this episode. Does Professor Martin think Euclid will find brown dwarfs? He told me in this recording That is what I put in the proposal, so we had better now.
Research Professor Eduardo L. Martin from the Instituto Astrofísica del Canarias here in Tenerife. Professor, thank you very much for making the time.
I'm glad to be here.
I'm going to be talking about the European Space Agency mission, Euclid. I know you have you're the principal investigator for part of the data from that mission. But before that, can you tell us how long this mission has been in the making and what's your involvement with it since when?
The mission was adopted by ESA, the European Space Agency, in 2011. There had been proposals before that, but the successful proposal that was finally adopted by the agency was that in 2011. And in 2012, the agency issued an announcement of opportunity for an independent legacy scientist in the Euclid science team. I responded to that. It was a competitive process, and I got it. So I've been part of the Euclid science team since 2012.
What's the reference to the legacy bit? I didn't understand that.
The legacy is what Euclid is contributing as a legacy to mankind.
Ah.
It's not the specific goals that Euclid has.
Right.
For that, there are the people who led the proposal that was adopted by ESA. And they had made up the Euclid Consortium, which is a very, very large collaboration with 13 European countries involved, 300 institutions. Also, some institutions from the US and from Japan and Canada. I'm not part of that.
Right.
I'm the small little group on the side, independent.
Well, it's like most of these interesting missions, it sounds like a very long in the making, very large in the number of participants, probably very expensive as well. What is the primary mission objective? Objectives for Euclid?
It's not expensive at all. We have to put it in context. The space missions are a one of a kind, and they respond to our needs as a species on Earth, projecting ourselves out of Earth. And it's one of those activities that only us can do. So we must do it. I think we have the responsibility to do that on behalf of planet Earth. So that's, when you look at that, it's not expensive at all. And it's also not expensive compared with other more mundane things. A space mission like Euclid is an incredible artifact and is a wide field telescope put in space far from us in a very stable location. It's called the second Lagrangian point. So it's very far from Earth.
That's where the James Webb telescope is.
Yes. And it's big enough for those big guys.
And why is that location important for a telescope like this?
Because the background light is very, very low. So you can take deep pictures of the sky with little noise, very little noise.
And you said it's wide field, so it's got some very large sensitive cameras. What is it that the data from this mission will help? What's the problem it's trying to solve?
The primary problem is to measure the fabric of the universe long time ago. It's a cosmological probe. It has several experiments that will provide new information about how the universe was formed, how it expanded, how the galaxies were structured in the in what we see now, big galaxy clusters, voids, So it's going to be an essential tool to understand the history of the universe.
So it was, you said, initially considered in 2011. It's launched last year. It's been operating for a few months. We already have some data from it. And it's trying to answer big questions about the origin of the nature and the evolution of the universe. So is it specifically these two mysterious phenomena of dark energy and dark matter that is trying to help understand?
Yes, indeed. So it has been called the Dark Universe Telescope. Right? It's going to probe dark things, and I'm working on smaller dark things. Uh-huh. I'm working on substellar mass objects, that they are the darkest substars. They are below stars.
So when you say substars, you mean mass, in terms of mass, they're smaller than like the sun?
Yes, they are less than 10 times the size of the sun. They are close to the size of Jupiter. Some of them are thought to be smaller than Jupiter.
And that's why you call them dark. Because of their lower mass, they're not as bright, so they look dark. So we understand the big picture of what Euclid is trying to understand. So we have matter in the universe, we have dark matter, and we have dark energy. What sort of quantities of the total mass of the universe are those three categories in? And I don't know, it's a tough question.
No, well, not at all. We have constraints from previous space missions and from ground-based surveys. And at the moment, our main theory is telling us that dark matter is a lot more heavy, so to speak, that you know it contributes more than visible matter to the structure of the universe. Mm-hmm. And there is something even stronger that is called dark energy, and we have no clue what it is.
That's why it's called dark. So just to get an idea of the quantities of each. So what you're saying is that the matter that astronomers can see in their telescopes is the physical matter that we can see, and that's about 5%?
Yeah, it's a few percent.
And then we have dark matter. So this is matter that we can't see. It's about 20%, 25%?
Yeah, well, it's some kind of influence that makes galaxies rotate and makes lensing of very distant objects. And when you count the matter that you can see in stars,
right,
is way below what you need to explain those gravitational effects. And gravitation is something that we think we understand pretty well.
So although it's dark, you know it exists because of its gravitational influences on the objects that you can see. So we've got this small amount of normal matter that we can see. Then we have dark matter, which in part is responsible for the gravitational lensing effect that we'll come back to, but also dark energy, and that's the most of the energy, most of the matter in the universe. And how do astronomers know of the existence of dark energy?
Well, that's because if there were no dark energy, then the universe could only have three fates, three course of evolution. One is that it could be flat meaning that it will expand forever, because it had just the right initial kick that gravitation could never counter forever. So it will become completely flat, keep expanding, but a very, very slow rate, and it will make it very, very flat. So that's one possibility. It was one possibility. Then there was the possibility that gravitation, the whole gravitational energy of the universe, will be enough to stop the expansion and make it come back in a ending in a big crunch. So kind of a cycle where you have the Big Bang started it and the big crunch finishing it. So that was also a possibility. And the last possibility was that the amount of mass in the universe did not have enough gravitation, total gravitation, to stop the expansion, and the expansion will just slow down, but very little, and just will keep going and make the universe inflate ever more. So none of the three were validated by the observations of supernovae. And so actually what they found, and they got the Nobel Prize for that, was a completely different thing. They found that what was actually happened in those supernova is that they strongly indicated the universe at those epochs was accelerating.
Right.
How could it be accelerating if there was not any other force than gravity? Gravity only makes things to attract.
Mm-hmm.
And gravity will make the universe to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
So something stronger than gravity at those big scales of the universe was counteracting the action of gravity and was stronger than gravity.
And who were these Nobel Prize winners you mentioned?
The accelerating expansion, this unexpected result from studying supernovae, was a competition between two teams, and they independently made the discovery of this accelerated expansion. They were led by Perlmutter, Saul Perlmutter, and by Brian Smith, and both of them got the Nobel Prize in 2011.
So this is really the significant big objective. What Euclid is trying to answer is trying to answer the question of why the universe is still expanding. What is the mysterious force that's there? Besides knowing that dark energy exists, and it's a force that's the opposite of gravity, do we know anything more about what dark energy is?
Not at all. We're searching in the dark, trying to we're searching for dark matter in the dark, trying to cover all parameter space, all kind of energies for these particles. And there are a lot of experiments and covering different range of energy with different techniques.
And I think I remember now one of the experiments in the 1920s where stars in the outer part of the galaxy, which were expected to be orbiting this core of the galaxy at a slower speed, were actually seen to be moving much faster. So a bit like the solar system, as you go from the inner planets, which move around the sun very quickly, to the outer planets, which get slower, you expected to see that kind of thing on a more larger galactic scale.
Yeah.
But it was, in fact, the other way around. Things far away from the core of the galaxy were moving faster. Therefore, you needed some additional form of energy to explain for that.
Of course, you are referring to the Keplerian law.
Yeah.
Orbits of the planets in the solar system, and then in the galaxy, the orbits of the stars are non-Keplerian.
So that's a much clearer way of saying it. Yes.
Yeah, this was discovered by Franz Zwicky and Vera Rubin.
Yeah,
and they didn't get the Nobel Prize. It's a new space mission from NASA.
Yeah.
That I recently joined, and is named after Nancy Roman. The survey that is named after Vera Rubin is from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's a new large telescope in Chile that is going to make an amazing large survey.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to observe the whole southern hemisphere sky.
Mm-hmm.
Every week or so. So it's called the Time Domain Survey, LST, Large Survey of Science in Time.
There are some women astronomers in the history of astronomy who are recognized finally as well. So we have matter that we can see, tiny 5% or so, dark matter that we can't see, and dark energy, which is the chunk of about 67%. So what's your role in the Euclid mission?
I'm an independent legacy scientist with a project to detect and characterize ultra-cool dwarfs, the coolest members of the Milky Way. And these ultra-cool dwarfs can have very low masses. They can be free-floating planets, or they can be brown dwarfs. So my science project is to advance the knowledge, the frontier of knowledge about these objects, discover many of them in the different components of the Milky Way. So the disk of the Milky Way where we are, but also the halo of the Milky Way. And in the halo of the Milky Way, we don't know yet these objects because they should be very faint. So we have calculated that they are within the reach of Euclid. But, of course, it's something very challenging. But,
Right. And that's why you needed to put the Euclid spacecraft in the L2 orbit, so it has the very minimum noise, so you can look at very faint objects.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what kind of instruments are on board? What kind of data are you expecting to get from those instruments?
There are two instruments, and they observe simultaneously, because they are located in two different branches and separated by a dichroic. So the light enters the telescope and is divided into the visual light. The visual light goes to the visual instrument, and the visual instrument is a set of 36 CCD detectors, large format CCD detectors, taking exquisite pictures of the sky in visible light. The other instrument operates at near infrared wavelengths and is more complex. It takes images in three different filters, and it also takes a slitless spectra. So during the time that the visible instrument is just taking a simple visible light picture without any filter, the near-infrared instrument is switching between these different modes and taking more complex arrays of data with near-infrared images in different colors and also spectroscopy.
So, you mentioned 36 CCDs for the optical imaging, and the other imaging zone all in the lower infrared?
Yes, the visible part was made in the UK. The PI is in London at the University College. And the near-infrared part was led by an institution in south of France, in Marseille. The near-infrared part is where we expect to be able to characterize with more information the objects, the millions of objects in the sky. And in the visible part, the advantage of the visible part is that it provides sharper images than the near-infrared, because the visible part has a lot more pixels, and the pictures have a resolution, a spatial resolution, three times better than the pictures in the near-infrared. So our best pictures are the ones taken by the visible instrument.
So in terms of resolution, then, I'm guessing much better than the images we used to get from Hubble?
No, it's not. Ah. No, it's a wide field telescope. Ah. So in 1 week, Euclid covers as much sky as Hubble in all its lifetime. So Hubble has taken amazing pictures with very high quality, but very, very small chunks of the sky.
Right.
Euclid is providing similar quality, not better than the Hubble.
Right.
Similar quality, but over a much larger field of view, including many, many more objects in the sky.
That's interesting. So, I mean, I'm familiar with CCDs. We have them in cameras, and a lot of amateur astronomers use them. But what's unique here is the number of them and the field of view and the fact that you can take one picture, which would otherwise involve many pictures. You could stick them together, but this is a unique thing. It's taking wide field view, very high resolution, fairly quickly.
Yes, that combination is what is unique about Euclid, and the stability and the darkness of the L2 position.
Now, you mentioned the other instrument for the infrared. You're doing different wavelengths, but also you mentioned spectroscopy. So is there some level of chemical analysis of what objects are being imaged?
Yes, it could be possible in the long run to have some information. We have started to work on that for some of the substellar objects that are of interest for us. And we can see that with the Euclid spectra, we can get the ratios of molecules such as methane to ammonia in the very cool atmospheres of these objects. And from that, with more analysis and more work, we could go to chemical abundances in and chemical equilibrium or disequilibrium in these very cool atmospheres. But the main goal of the Euclid spectroscopy, and that's really why it's there, is to measure emission lines from distant galaxies and provide redshifts. These redshifts are crucial to measure the fabric of the universe in distant times.
So there's quite a lot of information there. So you have very high resolution, very wide field. The redshift will give you like a 3D. It tells you how far away each one of these objects is. The fact that you're dealing with infrared, this is where your objects come in. They're very cool. The cooler objects are the ones that you can use the infrared sensors for. Will you be able to detect stars of the type that you're looking at, the very sub-sun mass stars, or indeed even rogue planets?
Yeah, that's what I put in the proposal. So we better do now that we got selected and funded. So now we have to deliver.
Yeah. So it
now becomes tricky.
It has returned some data already.
Yeah.
What kind of data has it returned, and what information can you share?
Almost nothing, because it's all under embargo. At the moment, ESA and the Euclid Consortium are very sensitive and very picky about what gets out.
Right.
There has been a couple of press releases, so I can tell you about things that were included in those press releases. One of the press releases was some of the first pictures taken by Euclid. And I led one of them. The one with the Horsehead Nebula in the Orion constellation, that's the stellar nursery. It was among the pictures released, was the nearest to us, was the closest region to us. And there we have been looking in the past for rogue planets, and we detected some candidates. Now with Euclid, we are checking those candidates to see if we can verify their nature or not. And also we are looking for fainter ones that, according to the theoretical evolutionary models that we have, they could have lower masses. We are estimating that doing a reasonable job with the data, we can get down to about 2 times the mass of Jupiter. And that's about a factor of 3 better limits than what we had before Jupiter.
So will this potentially assist with detection of extrasolar planets, perhaps smaller planets nearby, but larger planets, but further away?
Yes, yes. Euclid can detect planets widely separated from the parent star. Depending on the age of the star and the distance to the star, the limits that Euclid can get in terms of the mass of the planet that, and the separation to the star vary. So it's it's a function of several parameters. But, well, I can tell you that Euclid could detect planet 9, if it exists, around the Sun. It will struggle to detect it around the nearest star. The planet 9 will need to be pretty big for Euclid to detect it in the around the nearest stars and brown dwarfs that we know in the solar neighborhood.
So it's interesting because planet 9 has been in the news again. So this is the planet in or near the orbit, orbit of Neptune or Pluto. It's been looked for a very long time. You're quite clear. If it exists, Euclid could find it?
It could. Euclid can improve the limits of detection for that kind of planet. So it could detect it if this planet 9 has a mass and a distance that are within the limits of Euclid. Also, a problem with Euclid is that it doesn't cover the whole sky. So Euclid, even though it's a large area, Euclid is funded to last for 6 years. And in those 6 years, is going to cover about one third of the sky, and so that, it's a matter of luck.
Okay, so I'll come back to that in a second. But is the search for Planet Nine a potential target? Is that something that is somebody's objective to look for, or will it automatically, in the course of its observations over the 6 years, cover that part of the sky where Planet Nine could be?
At the moment, the search for Planet Nine is not part of any of the Euclid science objectives. A search for Planet Nine, a dedicated search for Planet Nine, could be proposed for the extension of the lifetime of the Euclid mission. So we expect that Euclid may last longer than the cosmological surveys that are approved.
Right.
So when those are finished, then there can be room, there can be possibilities to propose for additional science topics.
But assuming that Euclid will be looking along the ecliptic, if it's going around the Earth 6 times in the 6 years, it will automatically cover the part of the sky where Planet Nine could be, without it being a special targeted goal. So it could find it accidentally.
It could find it accidentally, but it's not covering all the part of the sky where it could be, because Euclid is doing cosmological surveys and is pointing in some prearranged strategy to cover the deepest parts of the sky where there is less light, diffuse light. And for example, the ecliptic is not a very good place for Euclid in terms of going deep for extragalactic and cosmological purpose, because there is dust. So the, in the ecliptic, the dust is obscuring and making the images less sensitive to the deep sky that Euclid is probing.
So the one third of the sky that Euclid will look at are all the dark parts of the universe from its vantage point.
The dark parts of the universe from our vantage point.
Yeah. And so I take it then that the Milky Way, and certainly the core of the Milky Way, is also a part of the sky that Euclid will not look at.
Yeah, that is excluded from the main surveys. And some people are very excited to observe it with Euclid, and they are asking for Euclid to do that. But they have to wait, because first Euclid has to do what it has to do, what it was designed for doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are a lot of things. And you asked me before, what is the legacy?
Yeah.
So that is the legacy. All those projects that are not the core cosmological goal, mm-hmm. they are in general called legacy. Legacy of Euclid, because Euclid can serve for a lot of things.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the legacy of Euclid, is the science that Euclid can enable at large.
Mm. You mentioned the photograph that it has already returned of the Horsehead Nebula in Orion. Apart from confirming that all the systems were working correctly on it, and I have seen the image, it's a beautiful image. Did it reveal anything in the way of new science that previous images of that part of the sky had not?
Yes, that's what we are working on that, like mad people. So in this region, our first science goal is to characterize and detect the lowest mass population,
yeah.
reaching down to a few Jupiter masses.
Mm.
So we are learning how to use this data properly, because it's very new data, and we have to do our own calibrations to go step by step to have some confidence in going to the next step, because the next step is into the unknown. So we have to be very careful with that step. So yes and no. So I can tell you, yes, almost each day I get excited with some really exciting object that could be a rogue planet or a distant planet around a very young star. Almost by day, and almost by day, I also get almost depressed, because then we find something else, some problem with that particular object, by looking at all the different angles, all the different aspects that we need to do. We have to check each of them extremely carefully. It's really very exciting, but very hard. Fortunately, I have a senior postdoctoral colleague funded by the European Research Council, mm-hmm. Marusa Serhal, and she's working full-time on this, and also a student from Salamanca, Diego Martín. And then we have our colleagues around us, sometimes helping, sometimes trying to help. Mm-hmm. It's really something very exciting, and what I can tell you is this is a win-win situation, because we are going deeper and with a better image quality than ever before for most of the area that we are studying. Be that we detect a lot of planets, that will be great. If we don't, that will also tell us something about the secrets of Mother Nature.
Yeah. Two questions about the data that you're getting from this instrument. Keep forgetting that you, as astrophysicists, once you get the image, you can't just stop there. You have to analyze it and then analyze individual objects within the image. And that takes a lot of data analysis and data reduction. Are you using any of the new machine learning or neural networks to help with that data analysis?
We began to use that. So it's called a classifier based on artificial intelligence and neural network and all that. But I must say, for our particular project,
mm-hmm.
we have found that not to be as reliable as the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
That when we apply that We find too many fake objects that we wouldn't find if we apply other criteria. And also, we don't find some objects that should be there. So we have a few benchmark objects that we know are there. And sometimes we apply these techniques and the machine doesn't return the object that we know is there. So then we become not convinced that this is trustworthy.
Yeah.
It's very efficient, it's very fast.
Mm-hmm.
But for our particular project that we're kind of looking for the needle in the haystack, we're kind of looking for one object among thousands and thousands of objects that look similar, but they are not the one, the real one that that we are after.
That's been the experience of AI tools. I think in a few years' time, they will be better. But right now, as you say, the human brain.
I will believe it when I get convinced by running some tests like we're doing, and then if these techniques pass all these tests and comparisons with what we humans, like you know, my postdoc, my student, myself. What we are doing, yes, we are spending a lot of time, weeks and weeks of full-time work, and for a work that maybe will take 1 hour for a big machine. But it's really worth it. It's really worth it. We are becoming familiarized in very deep ways that I don't think we can really train a machine how to do that. It's so complex. It's really, you know, iterating process. It's a trial and error again and again. And it takes a lot of, I don't know, I think it's a very human thing.
Ultimately, I think that's where we'll end up. But I think we'll have to wait and see, give these tools some time.
No, it may be great for other purpose, you know, just for us. This is has not been helpful so far.
That's the key.
Yeah.
So the other question I have about the data that Euclid is returning, you mentioned this wide field camera, CCD, I think it's a 600 megapixel. That's quite a lot of data. So coming to Earth from the Lagrangian point 2, I would imagine with all the other missions which are live right now, this is quite an additional demand on the European Deep Space Network. Is that not just of Euclid, but other missions? Is that causing a problem for data communication capacity, do you think?
I think it does. We're just at the beginning of Euclid. But we know Euclid is going to provide more data than all ESA missions together ever before.
All of them.
Oh, by far. So we're just starting to face it, and we are facing real problems.
Right.
And we have been preparing for it.
Yeah.
But nothing prepares for the tsunami when it really arrives.
So there is some, ESA is preparing some sort of technical upgrade to its receiving stations here on Earth?
Well, the receiving part seems to be okay. I mean, they don't want to keep everything because it's too much. So there is a struggle between ESA and scientists, because scientists want to keep all the data, because we know we process data, we interpret the data, then we find something that was not quite right, then we have to go back to the beginning again and again, again and again, and we need to be able to go back to the beginning. But ESA is telling us, okay, no, you get the initial data at the beginning, we give to you the data products, but we cannot keep all that raw data.
And that's simply a problem of data storage here on Earth?
I'm not. I don't think it's mainly a problem of storage.
Right.
I think it's a problem of having the secure access to the data and all the different data transfer and things like that. But I mean, of course, it's many petabytes of data, but I don't think it's really that's the. I think it's a problem. It's not there is solution to the problem, but it's just that ESA doesn't want to do it because it's expensive, because they also have other missions and limited resources.
Yeah.
So
it's astonishing that we are in this position where the quantity of data that's being returned from a mission designed over that such a long time is a problem. But I remember the Large Hadron Collider. They have a similar problem. There's just so much data. So just I'm curious, because you work with this data on a first-hand basis. So when, let's say, Euclid takes a picture and downloads it somewhere, you get access to it straight away?
No. I do have access to on-the-fly data. But now I got access to on-the-fly data that was taken 1 month ago. So I don't have access to real-time
the raw data.
There's some pre-processing that needs to be done for me to be able to access the data and to understand the data. So it has to be pre-processed by engineers in the ESA stations, in Darmstadt, and in Villafranca del Castillo, places like that, where ESA has the expertise to do that and provide us with the raw data, but it's already pre-processed. This raw data is not really the original data that is actually arriving from the spacecraft.
You've been active in this mission for quite some time. You've got some data already, and I really now understand from talking to you directly that just getting the images is not the end of the problem, it's the start. There's a lot of work that's going to go on before you get the answers to the questions. But what is going to be happening with the Euclid mission in terms of milestones for this year?
For this year, well, first, we are working on a first battery of papers with Euclid data. There is an agreement with Astronomy Astrophysics to have a special issue in the fall. And there will also be a workshop where the scientists involved in Euclid are going to be there to explain the public how to use the data, what we have learned from these months of working with the Euclid data. So the plan is that the first sort of early data release will happen in late May. Then we will have this workshop probably in September or October, and then we will have the first publications with they are now in the making, and I'm one of the leading authors for one of them, and that's the reason why I'm not sleeping enough.
And that's as hard as that is, that's the exciting part. I know you find it exciting too, as I do, but you have to do all the hard work. I can just admire the pictures and the work you do. Professor, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks to you. It has been a pleasure.